Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us back in the VIP tent this week is Colonel Corey Drew. Hello, Corey. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm getting a dizzy from all the different ranks that I've had as I progress up and down through the military ranks here.
Well, the longer you serve on the show, the higher up you go. I don't know what we're going to be at by the time we get to season 11. You're going to be, I guess, just president at that point. I don't know if that's going to move up the ladder as we go. And we're already in we're in season three, but we have a ways to go. But again, thank you for coming back. You know, I always love having you on MASHcast.
Yeah, this is a great time for me every time.
Thank you. So we're here to talk about season three, episode 12, A Full Rich Day. Original air date, December 3rd, 1974, written by John D. Hess and directed by Gene Reynolds. Hawkeye, in possession of a fancy new tape recorder, decides to recite a letter home to his dad, relating the events of what he calls A Full Rich Day. First, during triage, Frank and Klinger have to deal with a Turkish soldier who, even though he is wounded, refuses to be separated from his fellow Turks, yelling and brandishing a knife in the process. Meanwhile, Radar is trying to find a lieutenant from Luxembourg who was supposed to be on the bus along with the other wounded. Then, a GI named Smith arrives, demanding his sergeant be seen immediately. When Frank refuses, the GI points his rifle at Frank, saying in no uncertain terms that that's not the right answer. Frank scurries off to get Henry. Smith then walks into pre-op and makes the same request. Hawkeye takes Smith aside while Henry takes a look at the sergeant. Smith reluctantly agrees, but quickly grows tired of Hawkeye's small talk and theory about how each of them see the war differently. They take the sergeant in and start to work on him, with Smith waiting outside. As if that wasn't tense enough, the angry Turk brought in earlier gets up from the table and his escape from the OR accidentally sticks Henry with a needle, knocking him out. After waking up, Henry is met by Colonel Blanche, who was told that his lieutenant was at the 477th. At first, he is told the lieutenant died, which is bad enough. But it gets worse when Radar has to inform Henry and Colonel Blanche that the corpse is missing. Henry tells Radar to drop everything and find the body. Trapper and Frank help fix up the sergeant, while Radar, in search of the missing corpse, finds the Turk hiding out in the kitchen. He grabs Hawkeye, and they try and corral him. After trying to communicate with him in his own language, Hawkeye decides to put a drug in the drink he hands to the Turk. He tells Radar it will take a few minutes for it to hit, so he puts the Turk in a jeep with Radar. When the Turk passes out, Radar is to turn right around and return to the 47 so the Turk can be patched up. Later, Hawkeye and Trapper tell Smith his sergeant will be fine, but then Smith collapses in their arms. He's badly wounded as well. Unable to find the missing body, Henry offers to have a memorial for the lieutenant, which Colonel Blanche agrees to. They play the national anthem of Luxembourg, and as it rings out over the PA, we see a heavily bandaged soldier laying in post-op, so stirred that he struggles to get up and walk into the compound. Turns out this is Lieutenant Leclerc, who is not dead after all. Colonel Blanche is overjoyed and embraces the man, but gently. Moments later, the jeep with Radar and the Turk returns, but with the Turk driving and a passed-out Radar. He hands Radar over to Hawkeye, calls him a damn good Joe, and drives off. The end of one very weird day at the 477th. All right, so, Corey, why did you want to talk about this episode?
Well, you know, I'm a sucker for those letter home episodes,
right?
I think. I really love the conceit of those. I think it's a nice device for doing that type of story. And then on top of it, they almost always tend to be a sort of day in the life kind of tale, which, you know, again, is another thing I'm a sucker for. It doesn't matter what the genre, what the show, whatever it is. I love those sort of just a little window into a day in the life of whatever characters in whatever setting. It's always fun. And this one, you know, it fits the mold of that. I picked this one of the episodes available.
It feels like a cheat not calling it Dear Dad 4 or whatever, because it literally opens with Hawkeye saying Dear Dad. And of course, in the previous Dear Dad episodes, it was a voiceover because Hawkeye's writing a note. But here they just decide to say, let's just get on Alan Alda to narrate the thing and give him a tape recorder. You know, I mean, which is, again, another cheat, but it's a fun cheat because it's like, well, it's better to have Alan Alda reciting the lines in front of you as opposed to just doing voiceover. I do like the callback. It's kind of a gross callback, but it opens with Trapper cutting his toenails, which Hawkeye refers to. He says the trapper sells him as war souvenirs to tourists. But in an episode, a couple episodes previous, in Alcoholics Unanimous, one of the things that gets Hawkeye so irritated by Trapper is he talks about the Trapper is always cutting his toenails and leaving them under Hawkeye's bunk, which irritates Hawkeye to no end. So I love that callback. Like, here's Trapper doing that. I'm guessing when you live in the tent with somebody in this close quarters, you're really going to get familiar with each other very quickly, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that's a great sort of continuity, you know, that ties the season or the episodes together in a way that, you know, is rewarded, I think, when you can watch them in rapid succession in a way that maybe you wouldn't quite pick up on if you were watching it like 1 week and then a week later.
Right. Yeah, I love that little detail. It is interesting that over in the voiceover, and this is of course is for the benefit of the audience, that Hawkeye explains to his father what triage is. Hawkeye's dad is a doctor. I'm pretty sure that Hawkeye's dad knows what triage is, but you know, okay, that's for the benefit of us that he does that little bit of lampshade hanging there.
Yeah. I have to say, as much as I enjoy the conceit in every episode, they do slightly abandon it. You know, it plays much less of a role, I think, in previous episodes where it has been. I mean, I think maybe perhaps part of it is because he is recording it. It's just his voice. It's not a shot of him sitting there writing, you know, and happening in his head, as it were, you know, and they keep it up. You know, it's there. It bookends the episode, but it becomes less and less prevalent as the episode progresses in its presence, I think.
Yeah, it's just like, right, it does. But you do forget about that after a while. And it comes back at the end, and I'll mention that because there's a really great moment that I want to talk about, the Hawkeye doing the actual narration. But we get to the scene on the bus where they discover the Mad Turk, which they call him. He's played by an actor named Siri Murad. He did two MASHes. He was in movies like Cleopatra Jones, which is fun. He was in a TV series called Beyond Westworld, which I didn't even know existed. I mean, I knew the Westworld movies, and of course there's a Westworld series on now, but apparently there was a Westworld series in the late 70s. I had no idea. So he was on that show. He made appearances on in Remington Steele. He's done lots of little credits, but he's fun here because I love that they call him a sandwich case, where they put him in two stretchers bound together and he cuts his way through them. And I guess the idea is, and Hawkeye mentions this, is that there are so many different people fighting in this war that, of course, not everybody can communicate with one another. So this Turk doesn't understand that he's wounded and they need to be patched up. And it's, of course, his only, you know, when someone wants to take him off the front lines, he brandishes a knife, presumably, at people. So they fill him up with morphine and send him to the 477th, kind of like making him their problem, which is very funny.
Yeah. That's pretty great.
Later on, we're introduced to the character played by Lieutenant Smith. He's played by William Watson. He passed away in 1997. He was in shows like Streets of San Francisco. He's in the film Shadow's Land with Charles Bronson. He was in The Mac, the blaxploitation movie The Mac, Executive Action, Roots, It's Alive 3. He kind of an all-over-the-place career. I like this guy's performance because I love how quiet he is. Where he pulls up and you see he's covered in what looks like paint. I mean, it can't be paint.
Mud, I was thinking. Maybe it was mud.
I guess so. It looks like it's white, but I mean, it's probably more like a tan color. But yeah, but I love how quiet he is, where he's just like, you're going to see my loose sergeant. He's one of the greatest men in the world, right? And he's just got this very quiet kind of like, and he brandishes a weapon at Frank. And Frank actually is initially kind of brave. He stands up to the guy, which is very, very not typical of Frank Byrne.
Yeah, I felt like that was a sort of a step away from his character initially when I saw that. But then I thought, no, if there's one thing Frank loves more than anything, it's authority and having it. And I can see how that drive would trump, pardon the pun, his common sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like, always a little slower on the uptake than everybody else anyway. And he overcompensates for that by being, you know, very authoritarian. And in that instance, you know, initially I was like, well, wait a second. Frank's, you know, he's sort of a coward. Not sort of. Frank is a coward.
Yeah.
And that moment I was like, oh, I don't know. But then after giving it some thought, no, it actually, you know, it actually did make sense for him to be like, no, listen, I'm in charge here, bucko. Oh, wait, no, you've got a gun. You're in charge. Never mind.
He's so sure that his rank will protect him that he would even mouth off to somebody brandishing a rifle in front of him, which is, again, very, very scary. I love the way this actor does this. I love just how he underplays it, and I really think that's it's really well done. He is concerned with saving the life of his sergeant, and that's all that he cares about, which I think is really great. The guy has amazing blue eyes, too. In these close-ups, he has really stunning blue eyes. In the pre-op scene, there is a line that is very curious where Klinger is helping Hawkeye with a different patient. And I went back and listened to the line, and I even read it on the subtitles to make sure I heard it right. Klinger says, "I gave him half a grain of morphine."
Yeah.
I gave him half a gram of – I'm pretty sure Klinger is not medically qualified to give anybody morphine.
Yeah, I caught that myself. You know, that guy, Smitty, he's very, very menacing.
Yep.
With very little effort. Mm-hmm. And I think a part of it is like those blue eyes. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's got the kind of like Night King from Game of Thrones thing going on. You're just like, ooh, he's cold. Like there's like just some murder waiting to happen. And it's funny in the scene where he was outside talking with Hawkeye, I noticed his very blue eyes and that got me looking at Hawkeye's eyes. I guess I'd never noticed his eyes are blue too.
Mm-hmm.
Never noticed.
Well, yeah. William Smith's eyes are, as you said, they are like the Ice King. I mean, they are really, he really has a great 1,000-yard stare. And again, the scene with him and Hawkeye is fantastic. And again, another little great moment where Hawkeye is trying to talk to him sort of as man to man. And then when he breaks out the line about this isn't a geopolitical conflict over nations and ideologies. And you could see Smith kind of goes like he rolls his eyes a little bit like, all right, this guy's full of shit. And that's when he starts to walk away and Hawkeye stops him. But I love just that slight little kind of like, I don't have time for this nonsense. I'm worried about my sergeant. I don't know what this guy's talking about. I think it's a great understated little moment.
Yeah, I like that scene a great deal. And one of the things though that threw me for a loop was kind of back to the whole explaining what triage is when he said it was the only book his dad ever read. I was like, Last of the Mohicans was the only book his dad ever read. To me, that was like sort of it changed the tenor of that conversation from one of him being sincere and trying to have this guy rationalize things to one of him being kind of a bullshit artist and just kind of trying to bullshit this guy. And then that comes back later on when he says the same thing. He uses the same speech on the Turkish guy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, this is just a canned speech he has tucked away in his back pocket, and he turns on the Crabapple Cove charm, and all of a sudden, or Crabapple Cove, right? Not cranberry.
Yeah, Crabapple. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a series of books that feature a cranberry cove. So anyway, the Crabapple Cove charm, and hopes he can flash his baby blues at somebody, but that guy's baby blues were bluer. It's like, you're not going to succeed at this. And the whole time, you know he's not going to succeed at it. You know what I mean? You know how it's going to end. But he still gives it a yeoman's effort. And it's just like, it's one of those moments where it's a really interesting inclusion in the episode.
Right. Clearly, Hawkeye, I mean, obviously, with his father being a doctor, I'm sure that his father has read more than one book in his life. Right. And it's clearly just a little cute little folksy charm aphorism, because he uses that line in later episodes when he describes his father to other people. He says, it's the only book my father ever read, which you're like, well, his father's an educated man. I'm pretty sure he read more than just Last of the Mohicans. But I do like that scene that you mentioned, the second scene with the Turk, where he tries it again and the Turk like just slams the cleaver down. And I like that Hawkeye sort of comments to nobody in particular. That's twice that didn't work. Like, he realizes it's a bullshit story that nobody really subscribes to. I like that he sort of admits that. He's like, yeah, this is canned. This is not working for anybody.
Yeah, it kind of gives me – like, the way I'm viewing it is kind of like it's almost pandering, you know? Like, he's like, okay, here's a guy from the front. He's a soldier. I'm going to, like, dumb down my background a little bit.
Yeah, yep.
To sort of try to be on the same plane as him, on the same level. And really, in that moment – that guy is not on Hawkeye's level at all. He's above it because he's holding him hostage. And it's like, it's a great, I think it's a really interesting illustration of a complicated idea that I'm sure if you have military experience, you know, from the enlisted perspective or from the commissioned perspective, you've encountered this.
Yeah.
Right? This exact experience. And I love that they included that scene. It wasn't necessary. It didn't really move the plot forward, but it was there and it kind of gave you this, I don't know. I won't go so far as to say it tarnished Hawkeye's armor, but it put a, you know, it put some spots on it, you know, it's like, okay, so the shining armor is not quite so shiny. He's got some bad habits too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He does talk down to the guy a little bit. I mean, the guy obviously is not all there because he's so laser focused on this goal and they have to try and talk to him. It's like, hey, look, we can't just do what you want because you're brandishing a rifle. But yeah, he is kind of talking down to the guy a little bit. And I like that the guy, he even admits to Hawkeye. He says, well, I see your point. I guess you're right. Now get in there and fix Sergeant Smith, Captain Smith. So it's like, you know, Lieutenant Brian. That's what you're, Lieutenant Brian. Like he listens to it all. He even understands it. And he's just like, yeah, but do it anyway. You're like, oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. That's fine.
He concedes that he's correct, but he remains, he insists that he doesn't care. And he has, you know, the authority to do that because he is armed.
Yeah.
That scene is really, really well done.
Yeah. And it's, again, it's that actor that I mentioned, like he didn't have like a really long career. And yet he's really good here. I mean, it's like one of those things of, well, this guy should have done more stuff because he was really, really sharp in a very brief couple of scenes in this one episode of MASH. So after that scene, we have the scene in Henry's office where Colonel Blanche shows up. Colonel Blanche is played by an actor named Kurt Lowens, who just passed away a couple of years ago, 2017. He had quite an amazing career. He was in films like Angels and Demons, The Miracle of St. Anna, A Midnight Clear. He was on The A-Team, Wonder Woman, The Streets of San Francisco. Another guy who was on Streets of San Francisco. He was in Hitchcock's Torn Curtain. He was in the wonderfully titled film Werewolf in a Girl's Dormitory, which makes me, I kind of want to see that. And that scene where they find out that the body is missing is pure, you know, like farce. It's just silliness. Mm-hmm. Where, I mean, it's a little grim because they're talking about losing a dead body, but it is very, very silly of just that it's Radar's like, well, mm-hmm. And they have to realize that. And you have to think that in a place like MASH 477 where they are dealing with hundreds of bodies, hundreds of people in any given week, you probably would maybe lose one or two here. I mean, you would think they would show up eventually, but you have to think it happens sometime.
I mean, the best method, you know, that we had at that time for keeping track of people's comings and goings was dog tags.
Right.
Right. And those can get lost.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. It was very, yeah, I would have to think it happened more often than we'd like. On the other hand, truly, though, I think the fact that it didn't happen more often than it did is really the astonishing.
Radar is very good at his job. This is a rare screw-up for Radar, but it's not even a screw-up for Radar because we find out later that, of course, Lieutenant Leclerc is in post-op, and it's because he's so bandaged up that you probably – his dog tags are probably covered up or something, and nobody knows that that's like, so he's, in fact – not dead, and poor Radar has to kind of take the hit for it. And I liked the way that Kurt Lowens plays it, where, you know, he finally says, well, he died, and he says, well, those are the fortunes of war. And he says, well, I want to bring the body back for a proper military burial. And he says, well, we lost the body. He says, that is not the fortunes of war. And then, and of course, and then Henry, you know, picks up how upset Colonel Owens is, and, you know, says there'll be no not finding him, and he heads out. And then we have this whole other scene, which is with the Turkish soldier, where he's got a cleaver and he's hiding up in the kitchen, and all, you know, he's scared and he just wants to get out of there. And I don't know about you, I always find cleavers to be just very frightening. Like, just playing around with them is upsetting, and watching Hawkeye and this guy slam these cleavers down always makes me a little nervous, because they're probably prop cleavers, but the sound of it is great when they're going into the wood block, is this thunk and thunk, and it always just makes me nervous when somebody's playing around with blades that big and sharp.
It looked pretty real.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to the wood. I mean, I used to have to, when I worked at a restaurant, I had to use a cleaver periodically, and they are a hefty blade, and that looked very much like real cleavers.
Maybe so. Maybe they just trusted Alan Alda and Suri Murad to going to do it. And so then Hawkeye comes up with the alternative plan, which is we're going to drug him and Radar get undressed, and you're going to put him in the Jeep, and we're going to drive out. And then that's the intercut with Smith watching Hawkeye and Trapper perform surgery on the lieutenant, and we see that Frank is a little nervous, and Smith is just standing there with his gun, and Trapper gives him a little bit of grief too, where he's like, "Hey man, this buddy is hard enough. You don't make it any easier standing there, pointing that gun in our direction." And again, I love that. You know, they're kind of like, they're trying to get this guy, like, dude, you got to unclench a little bit. And again, he's not having it. Like, he listens to Hawkeye. Trapper. He listens to Trapper and Frank, but he's like, just keep working. Like, he's not listening at all.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like, I was watching that and I was thinking, you know, Trapper he's pretty gutsy.
Yep.
And if he had been out there by the bus when that guy came by with a gun, it would have been a very different, I think, outcome. I don't think it would have gone down quite like that. And I guess I didn't realize how gutsy Trapper was until that happened. I always just kind of thought of him as like, you know, sort of a laid back kind of, I mean, not quite as laid back as BJ, but
no.
You know, kind of like, you know, like at the end, how he's just sitting there drinking his martini and playing his ukulele. Like, that's how I think of him. And he's kind of boss in that scene. Like, like, you know what? Screw you. Screw the host you rode in on. You got a gun. I'm not going to, you know, come at you. But, you know, if you turned, I probably would.
Yep. And then back to the scene with Hawkeye and Radar and the Turkish soldier. And it's so silly, but I laugh at every line reading that the Turkish soldier had where he's trying to emulate what Hawkeye is saying. At one point, he calls Hawkeye a damn good Joe. And he says, he's telling Radar, going to take him out in the Jeep. And he says, and then, you know, eventually he's going to fall asleep and bango. And he's bango. And then when he talks about the drug that he's put in the drink, and he says, to chlorohydrate. And the guy just goes, chlorohydrate. Mm-hmm. Like, he just can't, he has no idea what he's saying. I just laugh at it every time. It was very silly.
I love that whole bit where he's like telling Radar step by step what to do.
Yep.
And the guy's just sitting there. He's just putting on Radar's clothes.
Yep.
Radar has kind of a weird journey in this episode. Like, like he, you know, he's got a lot of strange things going on. He's kind of here and there and everywhere in this episode.
Over the course of the seasons, nobody gets undressed on MASH more than Radar. And of course, that's the character that you want to get undressed because he's the most mortified by having to do it. So they're always having. And again, they were, you know, happened to hire, you know, the actor they hired to play the Turkish soldier just happens to be closer to Gary Berg off site than Alan Alda. So therefore, the joke works because obviously he's like, he's more your size kind of thing. The scene of Radar and the Turkish soldier driving out, we find that Radar has stolen the colonel's Jeep, the colonel from Luxembourg. And there's kind of a callback to the movie where they talk about there's all these runners in the movie about stealing Jeeps. And Colonel Blake is always like, oh, no, he didn't steal a Jeep. In fact, at the very final scene of the MASH movie, Colonel Blake asks Radar, Gary Berghoff, he's like, did Hawkeye steal that Jeep? And Radar's like, no, sir, it's the one he came in, which is, of course, the stolen one at the beginning of the movie. So it's kind of a runner there. But Henry has a great line where, you know, the colonel says, that's my Jeep. He says, oh, no, I don't think so, sir. And he's like, was he dressed in a toga? Well, yeah, there's so little for the men to do. Like, it makes a good excuse. Like, you know, maybe that's just something to just fill the time is dressed in a toga and drive around.
I kind of love that because that scene sort of hints at the ending, like the end result of that.
Yes.
Which is that Radar has dosed himself with the chloral, whatever.
Right.
And not dosed the Turkish soldier as he was intended to do. And, you know, Radar seems very kind of like, oh, don't look at me, whatever. And he gets in the wrong Jeep. And when the Jeep drives away, the camera angle that they use is this really chaotic, like, point of view angle.
Yeah. It's almost like a handheld thing.
Yeah, like, you know, like what you might see in, like, a drunk driving PSA or something. so they kind of give you these hints that, oh, something's gone wrong here. This isn't what you think. Because, you know, if it had been Radar victorious, you know, the scene would have been, you know, less chaotic. I think he took the Jeep kind of, because he was high.
I never thought of that. That had never occurred to me.
And he drove away like a maniac because he was high. And when they show him driving away, like, he doesn't look all there, you know? So they give you these little hints. And also they put him in a toga.
Right.
You know, so they give you these little hints along the way that they're in that scene, that this scene isn't going to end the way you think it's going to.
Right, yeah.
Then when you see him next, the Turkish soldier is bringing him back because he's passed out, because Radar's passed out from the laced prune juice, which, yeah. I think it's a fun twist.
Damn good, Joe. Damn good. And he pushes Hawkeye out of the Jeep, which is great. Yeah. And then we have the Leclerc memorial service, where we see the soldier hear his national anthem, and he wanders up into the post office. The actor here is Michael Keller. He appeared – he didn't have a lot of credits. He was in two different Elvis movies, though, Live a Little, Love a Little, and Stay Away Joe. And then he was in a documentary in 2004 called Addicted to Acting. And I looked him up, and it turns out he became an acting teacher. So this is one of these guys that only had a handful of credits, like a MASH episode, an episode from here or there, and then two Elvis movies, and then just became a teacher. So he's still active. So I guess, you know, he's able to say, hey, I was in some Elvis movies or something. He doesn't even get a line in the show. We just see him salute and wander out, and then the colonel says, Leclerc, and he hugs him, and he gets – and yep. Again, it's a physical piece of comedy because Leclerc is bandaged left and right and his arms in a cast, and when Colonel Blanche hugs him, you can see him, he's like, ooh, like he has like a little, like, you know, so it's, again, big, broad physical comedy. And I should – one of the things I noticed was at the memorial service for Leclerc, Klinger is wearing a robe and fuzzy slippers. So he really did not bother to dress up for this memorial service.
No, that is not proper mourning attire.
No.
You know, and I would have thought Klinger, of all people, would have had an outfit at the ready. Speaking of having things at the ready, if I were any person in the MASH cinematic universe, I would be the librarian for the 4077th, because not only did they have a Turkish dictionary on hand, they had a record with the Luxembourgian national anthem.
Jeez, yeah, I never even thought about that. You're right. Yeah, they had that. They had that on command.
Yeah, they just had that right there. It's not like they could, you know, just turn on Spotify back in the day. They had an LP. And they played it.
maybe all the units are issued like an album of all the different national anthems just for that very case, like the Russian national anthem, the French national anthem, the Luxembourg, for in case you have to do this very thing.
I wonder if that's true. Like, I wonder if they're like that's like some sort of piece of militariana where, you know, they provide your unit with some, you know, foreign language dictionaries and, you know, music, it just in that case. I mean, that wouldn't be the weirdest thing I've heard, that they provided, you know, military units back, you know, in the day.
Yeah, it's like the Olympics or something. One, a couple other things in this episode is that there is no Margaret. She does not appear in this episode at all. And then I do want to mention the credits for the director, the writer, John D. Hess. He wrote a couple of MASHes. He wrote on One Day at a Time. He was the head writer for a soap opera called The Young Marrieds, where he wrote 210 episodes of that show. Yeah. So, woo! Medical Center.
Full year of that show, though.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, probably. He also worked on The Streets of San Francisco, so there's a lot of that on this episode. He has no credits past 1978, although he died in 2004, so I guess he lived a life in retirement. And then the one last piece I want to mention, which is probably the most useless piece of trivia that IMDb will ever offer related to MASH or maybe anything. Somebody bothered to write on IMDb for this episode trivia that this episode aired on Ozzy Osbourne's 26th birthday.
Do you know what the first thing I wrote was when I was writing my notes?
What was that?
When this episode aired, I was 27 days old.
Okay, all right. I mean, that's at least somewhat related because you're here doing the episode with me. But I mean, there's no connection to Ozzy Osbourne in this episode. And it's not even like the day he was born. It's his 26th. Like, okay. I mean, I guess any TV show aired on somebody's birthday, if you want to dig deep down enough. I was just like, there's some Ozzy Osbourne fan that's just linking everything on IMDb to Ozzy Osbourne.
He or she just looked at the IMDb article and then was like, oh, hey, that's Ozzy Osbourne's birthday. I wonder how old he was then.
Yeah, I guess so. So thank you, Randy. random IMDb trivia poster for that completely useless piece of information. And then the episode ends with the button scene, just before the final credit scene. And I really like this final scene. In fact, the final scene is my favorite scene in the show. Not only does it have my favorite joke in the whole episode, which I'll get to in a moment, but I like the quietness of it. It just ends with Hawkeye talking into the mic. He gives Trapper one last bite at the apple. And then it just sort of ends with him just sort of sitting there, and he's smiling. He puts the mic in front of Frank Burns. Frank Burns, mm-hmm. Get that thing, it squirts water in my face. Frank laughs and he says, and then Radar's there too, and Henry's there. So they're all having kind of a nice party, and it just kind of ends quietly. Like it has this nice little melancholy end where he's just like, all right, Dad, that's pretty much it. And that's the end of the episode. I thought it's like a really nice, mellow way of ending. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I did too. I melancholy sums it up, right? Because he says, I hope I see you soon. Like, that's like such a, watching it, especially, 45 years later, that he doesn't see him soon. It's a very long, hard slog. And when he says that, and looking back on it, it's a very poignant moment. I like that. I think we are supposed to assume that Radar is still hungover
from the chlorohydrate.
Yeah, from the drugs, because he is passed the F out on that bed snoring. It's so funny.
There was
a line earlier where Hawkeye says he's got to give somebody a size 12 ectomy.
Yes. When they confront Smith in the post op and they come out and he says, hey, this isn't one of those war movies where you say, take my buddy, he's hurt worse than me. And right at that moment, Smith collapses and they check his shirt and they see that he's got a couple of internal injuries. And he says, get him into OR. And Trapper adds, he says, you can remove the shoe from my mouth. And that's when Hawkeye says it's a size 12 ectomy.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that I noticed about that line was that it was, what did they call that, ADR?
Yep.
It was additional
yep.
dialogue. And it was really egregiously so. Like, it was, I don't know if you, I know that's a lie. I do know that you have watched many, many episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, sure.
They replace, I would say, 60% of Worf's dialogue with ADR. And it is always like really egregious and it is really noticeable. And it takes me out of the episode every time they do it. And I guess I just have a thing against it because it happened to me again. When I was watching that, I was like, oh, that ADR was atrocious.
They can never quite get it right. Even with all the most modern technology we have nowadays, you can always hear it. You can always tell. It always just sounds a little different because, of course, they're recording it in a different setup. They're not recording it kind of in the set. Scene. They're doing it later on. But it's amazing that with all the technology we've got, they have not been able to crack that. You can always hear it. You can always just go, wait, that's not – now, yeah, it is pretty – I mean, part of it helps that Hawkeye is, like, not looking at the screen. I think he's looking at Smith at that point. So they figure they could get away with it. But, yeah, it is pretty obvious where he's like – it's like, you can remove the shoe from my mouth. It's about a size 12 ectomy. Like, it just comes – it's, like, a totally different sound from the rest of the scene.
Yeah, and, he's looking down when he says it.
Yeah.
So, like, which is very organic. And like, hearing him say it while looking down, maybe we would have had to strain to understand. But the money they spent to re-record it and splice it in, I don't feel was money well spent.
Is that your favorite joke from the episode, or do you have another one?
No, I guess it's not my favorite joke. My favorite line is sort of shockingly from Frank Burns. He's talking with Radar, and Radar says, sort of talks back to him and says, but Captain McIntyre said, and he says, I don't care what Captain McIntyre said. I have never cared. And at this moment, I don't care twice as much as I ever cared before. I love that. It's just so, circular, and it doesn't have, it doesn't make any sense, which is Frank Burns in a nutshell, but it's really well written. It's a really fun bit of wordplay. And the fact that they gave it to Frank, it's sort of one of the questions I often have when I'm watching Frank is he's unlikable. There's no point at which he's likable. And that's a hard thing to embody, I think, for an actor, right? To be like, okay, my job here is to be despicable in every way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Larry Linville had a tough lift every week on the show.
Yeah, every week. He was never allowed to get the laugh. He was never going to get the girl. He was, you know, he was never going to be, you know, the a moment that people looked back on and thought, oh, wow, that was a great moment for Frank, right? He always had to be just awful all the time. And that's hard to do a lot, you know, but they gave him that line. And that was a really well written line. And he delivered it really well. And he did it. And honestly, the way he delivered it wasn't his, you know, usual like false bravado. It was genuinely, you could tell he was saying it as though he had these feelings. He doesn't care. And he just couldn't, he was so angry about it that he couldn't make sense.
Right. It's gibberish. Yeah.
And I thought the way they did it and the fact that they gave him that line, which I mean, for my money is the best written bit of dialogue overall in this episode.
All right. Fair enough. My favorite line actually is from the scene we just talked about where Hawkeye is offering the mic to everybody for one last bit of business before he signs off to his dad. And I love that he puts the mic in front of Trapper's face and without missing a beat, Trapper just goes, hello, Dr. Pierce. Hello, Mr. Pierce. Your son's no good. I just love that. I love that so much that he's so comfortable with his buddy and he figures that his dad has got the same sense of humor as his son. So he'll understand that that is not meant to be actually insulting, but I just love how Hawkeye and Trapper can yes and each other. I just find that hysterical. I just love that. Hello, Mr. Pierce. Your son's no good. He just says it so plainly. I just laugh at it every time. It's just great. Again, I really have such a greater appreciation for Wayne Rogers having gone through these episodes, especially season 2 and 3, on the granular level like I'm doing. Like, he's just been really, really good. Again, BJ still my favorite character of all time, but Trapper and especially as played by Wayne Rogers is just so funny in these episodes. And again, it's a shame he didn't get more to do, but that's my favorite joke of the whole episode. So overall, it's a really fun show. Again, like you said, it's kind of like a Dear Dad, and that's just like a bunch of short storylines all smooshed together. They try and give it a little more coherence as saying it all happened in a 24-hour period. So making right. It like a full rich day. Like this was a weird, we see Hawkeye in the morning, we see him at night. That so everything took place in 24 hours. So it's all just a bunch of weirdness that goes on at the 477. That's overall, it's a very, very funny show. I mean, again, I think I've said every episode this season that this is really one of their best seasons ever. And every episode is just really, really good. So this is a solid, very funny episode. So thank you once again, Corey, for stopping by.
Yeah, no, for sure. Always happy to. It is a great show. Hey, I had a question for you. You have a greater depth of knowledge than I do when it comes to sort of weird colloquialisms and like old timey language.
Okay.
What the hell is a wagster?
I have no idea. I saw that in the subtitles that Frank refers to Hawkeye as a wagster. That one, I looked it up and I couldn't find anything. I have no idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even that's a little too deep of a cut for me even. I was like, okay. Yeah. No idea what that is. So if anybody out there listening knows what a wagster is, please let us know.
Yeah, it's obviously some kind of like slur, like a like pinko commie kind of slur. Well,
probably what it is, yeah.
You know, like lib. It's some variation on that, I'm certain, but I had never encountered it before.
And yeah.
That threw me.
Yeah, it was a little baffling. The subtitles can be very helpful watching these episodes with subtitles. You learn words that I never learned before. But yes, like I said, if you're listening to this and you know what a wagster is, please let us know. Actually, a perfect segue right over on the website. Go to FireAndWaterPodcast.com, leave a comment, and let us know what wagster is. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW podcasts, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Adam Sanders, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, and Suzanne Holland for their support of MASHcast. So again, Corey, thank you once again, my friend. It's always, always fun to talk to you no matter what show we're doing. So thanks so much for coming back to MASHcast again.
Sure. Anytime.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that is all. Thank you.
Your recipe is 4-1, is it not?
5-1, actually. 5 parts gin and 1 moment silence for the vermouth.
Thank you. I'm sure our listeners found that boring without actually being interesting at all.